down at his end of the counter. Every time he lost another hand of gin to Horace, he thought of some further improvement for the Empire Grill. "What's that, Walt?" Miles sighed, filling salt shakers at mid-counter. "You need to stop with this swill and start serving Green Mountain coffee." In his own opinion, Walt was on the cutting edge of all that was new and good in the world. In his fitness club, which he was forever hounding Miles to join, promising washboard abs, he'd recently introduced protein shakes, and he thought these might prove to be a hot item at the grill as well. Miles, of course, had ignored all such suggestions, thereby reinforcing Walt's contention that he was a congenitally backward man, destined to run a backward establishment. Walt expressed this view pretty much every day, leaving unanswered only the question of why he himself, a forward man in every sense of the word, chose to spend so much time in this backward venue.
"I bet you couldn't pass a blind taste test," said Horace, who usually took Miles' part in these disputes, especially since Miles appeared reluctant to defend himself against the relentless assaults on his personal philosophy.
"You kidding? Green Mountain coffee? Night and day difference," Walt said.
When the bell above the door tinkled again, Miles looked up and saw that this time it was his daughter, which meant that unless someone had given her a ride, she'd walked all the way up Empire Avenue from the river without his noticing. For some reason, this possibility unnerved him. Since he and Janine had separated, a separation of a different sort had occurred between himself and Tick, the exact nature of which he'd been trying for a long time to put his finger on. He wouldn't have blamed his daughter if she'd felt betrayed by his agreeing to divorce her mother, but apparently she didn't. She'd understood from the start that it was Janine's idea, and as a result, she'd been much tougher on her mother than on Miles, so tough that simple fairness had required him to remind her that the person who wants out of a marriage isn't necessarily the cause of its failure. He suspected, however, that whatever had changed in their relationship had more to do with himself than with his daughter. Since spring, he couldn't seem to get Tick to stand still long enough to get a good fix on her. She was maturing, of course, becoming a young woman instead of a kid, and he grasped that there were certain things going on with her that he didn't understand because he wasn't supposed to. Still, it troubled him to feel so out of sync. Too often he found himself needing to see her, as if only her physical presence could reassure him of her well-being. Yet when she did appear, she seemed different from the girl he'd been needing and worrying about. The week they'd spent together on the vineyard had been wonderful, and by the end of it, he'd felt much more in tune with Tick than at any time since he and Janine had separated. But since they'd come home, the disconnected feeling had returned with a vengeance, as if losing sight of her might lead to tragic consequences. Even now, instead of relief, he was visited by an alternative scenario. The screech of tires somewhere down the block, Tick's inert body lying in the street, an automobile speeding away, dragging her enormous backpack. Which had not happened, he reminded himself, quickly swallowing his panic. As she did every afternoon, Tick gave Walt Como wide berth, pretending not to see the arm he stretched out to her. "Hi, Uncle David," she said, rounding the far end of the counter and giving him a peck on the cheek.
"Hello, beautiful," David said, helping her off with her backpack, which thudded to the floor of the restaurant hard enough to make the water glasses and salt and pepper shakers jump along the lunch counter. "You gonna be my helper today?"
"What you got in that pack, sweetie pie? Rocks?"
Walt Como called the length of the counter. Rather than acknowledge his existence, Tick went over to Miles and buried her face in his apron, stretching her arms around his waist and hooking her fingers at his back.
"I've got ABBA in my head," she told him. "Make them go away."
"Sorry," Miles told her, drawing his child to him, feeling the smile spread across his face at her nearness, at her confidence in his ability to dispel the bad magic of old pop groups. Not that she was a child anymore, not really.
"Did you hear them on the radio?"
"No," she admitted. "They're his fault," meaning Walt. And with this accusation, she pulled away from her father and grabbed an apron. The reason it was Walt Como's fault was that Janine, Tick's mother, played Mamma Mia and Dancing Queen in her beginning and intermediate aerobics classes at Walt's fitness club, then hummed these same songs at home. Only her advanced steppers were deemed ready for the rigors of Barry Manilow and the Copacabana. "Your dad says you had a good time on the vineyard," David said, when Tick passed by on her way to the kitchen with a tub of dirty dishes. "I want to live there," she confessed, like someone who saw no harm in confessing a sin she was never likely to have the opportunity to commit. "There's a bookstore for sale on the beach road, but Daddy won't buy it." The door swung shut behind her. "How much?" David wondered, tossing down his paper, grabbing a clean apron, and joining his brother at mid-counter. He still had partial use of his damaged hand, but not much strength and very little dexterity. "Save me half an hour and tie this, will you?" Miles had already set down the salt shakers he was filling. "So?" David said when the knot cinched. "So what?" "How much was the bookstore?" "God, how come you can recite 25 consecutive breakfast orders and not remember a simple question I asked you 2 seconds ago?" "More like a book barn, actually," Miles said, since that was what it had once been. There'd been room enough downstairs to sell new books and set up a small cafe, since people seemed to think those belonged in bookstores now. The upstairs could be cleaned up and devoted to used books. There was even a small cottage on the property. The same couple had owned and run the business for about 20 years, but now the wife was sick and her husband was trying to talk himself into letting it go. Their kids didn't want any part of it after going away to college. "How come you know all that and not the price?" David wondered when Miles finished explaining. "I didn't actually see the listing. Peter just pointed the place out. I don't think he knew the asking price. He isn't interested in running a bookstore."
"They got a fitness club over there, big boy?"
Walt wanted to know.
"I don't know, Walt," Miles told him, trying to sound neutral about the idea. If anything in the world could ruin the island for him, it would be Walt Como's presence. Of course, the idea of a blowhard like the Silver Fox anywhere outside of Empire Falls was absurd, but Miles didn't dare laugh. A year ago, Walt had joked that if Miles wasn't careful, he was going to steal his wife, and then he'd gone ahead and done it. Walt scratched his chin thoughtfully while contemplating a discard.
"I figure my club here is doing pretty well, practically runs itself. Now might be a good time to expand."
He sounded as if his only obstacle was the matter of timing. The Silver Fox liked to imply that money was never a consideration, that every bank in Dexter County was eager to loan him whatever capital he didn't have. Miles doubted this was true, but it might be. He'd also doubted that his soon-to-be ex-wife was the sort of woman to be taken in by Walt Como's bravado, and he'd certainly been wrong about that.
"Go ahead and split if you want," David told him. "He'll be wanting to arm wrestle you in a minute."
Miles shrugged. "I think he just comes in to let me know there's no hard feelings." This elicited a chuckle. "About the way he stole your wife?"
"Some sins trail their own penance," Miles said softly, after glancing toward the back room, where Tick could be heard loading dirty dishes into the ancient Hobart. One of the few things Miles and Janine had been able to agree on when their marriage came apart was that they wouldn't speak ill of each other in front of their daughter. The agreement, Miles knew, worked much to his advantage, since most of the time he had no desire to speak ill of his ex-wife, whereas Janine always appeared to be strangling on her wretched opinion of him. Of course, all the other agreements they'd arrived at, such as letting her stay in the house until it sold, and the one that gave her the better car and most of their possessions, worked pretty much in Janine's favor, which left Miles staggering with debt.
"Tick really had a good time?"
Miles nodded.
"You should have seen her. She was like her old self before all the shit started raining down on her. She smiled for a solid week."
"Good. She met a boy, too."
"That always helps.
Don't tease her about it now."
"Okay," David promised, though it was one that would be hard for him to keep. Miles took off his apron and tossed it in the hamper by the door.
You should take a week yourself. Go someplace.
His brother shrugged. Why invite disaster? I'm down to one arm as it is. I ever let myself go someplace fun, I might start misbehaving, and then I'd have to flip your burgers with my toes.
He was right, of course. Miles knew his brother had been sober since the afternoon 3 years ago when, returning from a hunting trip in the county, David, drunk, had fallen asleep at the wheel and run his pickup off a mountain road into a ravine. Airborne, the truck had hit a tree, and there parted company with its unseat-belted driver, the vehicle careening a good 100 yards down the ravine and coming to rest well out of sight in the thick woods. David, thrown free of the cab, had gotten snagged by his hunting vest in the upper branches of a tree and hung there, some 50 feet above the ground, drifting in and out of consciousness, his arms shattered in several places and 4 ribs fractured, until he was discovered half frozen the next morning by a group of hunters, one of whom had stationed himself beneath the very tree David improbably dangled from, unable to utter a sound. If his bladder hadn't given way, as David was fond of remarking, he'd still be twisting there in the frigid wind, a sack of tough L.L. Bean outerwear full of bleached bones. That lonely, hallucinatory night had proved more effective than all the therapies he'd undergone in the various substance abuse clinics he'd been admitted to over the previous decade. His old Empire Falls drinking buddies, most of whom were still roaring around Dexter County in beer-laden snowmobiles, occasionally sought David out, hoping to nudge him gently off the wagon by reminding him how much more fun the drinking life was. But so far, he'd resisted their invitations. The year before, he'd bought a small camp in the woods off Small Pond Road, and he said that whenever he felt the urge to stare at the world through the brown glass of an empty beer bottle, all he had to do was walk outside on his deck and look up into the pines and listen again to the horrible sound the wind made in their upper branches. Miles hoped this was true. He'd been estranged from his brother at the time of the accident and continued to observe David warily, not doubting his brother's intention to reform, just his ability. He still smoked a little dope, Miles knew, and probably even had a small marijuana patch out in the woods, like half his rural Maine neighbors. But he hadn't had a drink since the accident, and he still wore the orange vest that had saved his life. Miles surveyed the restaurant, trying to see what he'd left undone. 1 week away had been sufficient to make it all seem unfamiliar. He'd spent most of yesterday trying to remember where things went. Only when he got busy and didn't have time to think did his body remember where they were. Today had been better, though not much. Okay, he said. You think of anything you need? David grinned. All kinds of stuff, but let's not get started. Okay, Miles agreed. You should think about it, Miles, David said from his knees where he was checking stores under the counter. About what? His brother just looked up at him. What? Miles repeated. David shrugged, went back to searching under the counter. Number 1, I can't afford it. At least not until I can sell this place. Number 2, Janine had never let me take Tick. And Tick is the one thing I won't let her have. And number 3, who'd look after Dad? His brother stood, a mega pack of napkins wedged under the elbow of his bad arm, a reminder that Miles had forgotten to fill the dispensers. Number 1, you don't know if you can afford it because you never found out how much it cost. The owner might be open to a little creative financing for the right buyer. Number 2, you could win Tick in court if you were willing to go there and duke it out. You're not the one who has to worry about being found an unfit parent. And number 3, Max Roby is the most self-sufficient man on the face of the earth. He only looks and acts helpless. So when you say you can't, what you really mean is that it wouldn't be easy, right? Have it your way, David, said Miles, who didn't feel like arguing. Give me those. But when he reached for the napkins, his brother turned deftly away. Go.
David, give me the damn napkins, Miles said. It was an easy job for a man with 2 good hands, a hard one for somebody with only one, and it did not escape Miles's attention that this seemed to be his brother's point. It would be difficult, but he'd do it anyway. For a man who'd hung by his vest 50 feet up in a tree and nearly frozen to death as a result of his own stupidity, David had always been strangely impatient with the failings of others. "Go on. Get out of here." Miles shook his head in surrender. "Did he come in at all last week?" "Max? 3 afternoons, actually." "You didn't let him near the register, I hope." Their father could not be trusted around money, though Miles and David had argued for years about the boundaries of his dishonesty. In Miles' opinion, there weren't any. David thought there were, even if they were not always easy to locate. For instance, he believed Max would take money out of his son's pockets, but not out of the restaurant's cash register. "I did pay him under the table, though." "I wish you wouldn't," Miles said. "I know you do. But why not pay him the way he wants? What difference does it make?" "For one thing, it's against the law. For another, Mrs. Whiting would have a cow if she thought I was doing anything off the books." "She'd probably prefer it, if she understood there'd be more money left over for her." "Possibly. It might also start her wondering. If I play fast and loose with the government, maybe I'm playing fast and loose with her, too." David nodded the way you do when you've been given an inadequate explanation, and decide to accept it anyway. "Okay, I got another question for you," he said, looking directly at Miles. "What makes you think that woman is ever going to give you this restaurant?"
"She said she would."
David nodded again. "I don't know, Miles," he said. Only one tub of dirty lunch dishes remained, but it was a big one, so Miles lugged it into the kitchen and set it on the drain board, stopping there to listen to the Hobart chug and whir, steam leaking from inside its stainless steel frame. They'd had this dishwasher for what, 20 years? 25? He was pretty sure it was there when Roger Sperry first hired him back in high school. It couldn't possibly have much more life in it, and if Miles had to guess when it would give out, it'd probably be the day after the restaurant became his. He'd spoken to Mrs. Whiting about replacing it, but a Hobart was a big-ticket item, and the old woman wouldn't hear of any such thing while it was still running. When Miles was feeling generous, he reminded himself that 70-something-year-old women probably didn't enjoy being told that things were old and worn out, that they'd already lived years beyond a normal life expectancy. In less charitable moods, he suspected his employer was shrewdly determined to time the obsolescence of every machine in the restaurant, the Hobart, the Garland range, the grill, the milk machine, to her own ultimate demise, thus minimizing her gift to him as much as possible. Their arrangement, struck nearly 20 years ago now, another lifetime it seemed to Miles, when Roger Sperry fell ill, was that he would run the restaurant for the remainder of Mrs. Whiting's life, then inherit the place. The deal had been struck in secret because Miles knew his mother would object to his dropping out of college in his senior year. For him to mortgage his future in order to be nearby during her illness would surely fill her with not just despair, but also fury. Mrs. Whiting herself had seemed aware that their fait accompli was necessary, that once Grace learned of the arrangement, she would talk Miles out of this futile gesture and remind him that she was going to die regardless, that compromising his own prospects was so perverse as to render meaningless her sacrifices on his behalf. Miles knew all this, too, and so he had conspired with Mrs. Whiting to give her no such opportunity. His mother's illness aside, taking over the Empire Grill had not seemed like such a terrible idea at the time. As a history major, Miles was coming to understand that it was unlikely he'd be able to find a job without a graduate degree, and there was no money for that. He'd started working at the restaurant during his junior year of high school, returning summers and holidays after going away to college, so no aspect of the restaurant's operation was beyond him. And while the living it promised would be hard, its rewards meager by the world's reckoning, by local standards, he would make out all right.
Why not run the joint for a few years and save some money? He could always finish school later. Mrs. Whiting would just have to understand. Of course, all that was before the textile mill closed, and the population of Empire Falls began to dwindle as families moved away in search of employment. And Miles, being young, did not know, since there was no way he could, that he'd never loved the restaurant as Roger Sperry had, or that the other man's affection for it had long been the primary engine of its survival. Despite his youth, Miles did understand that people didn't go to places like the Empire Grill for the food. After only two or three training shifts, he was a far better short-order cook than his mentor. Roger proudly proclaimed him a natural, by which he probably meant that Miles remembered what customers asked him for and then gave it to them, something Roger himself seldom managed to do. If he intuited any of Miles's shortcomings, he was too fond of the boy to share them with him. Only after taking over the restaurant did Miles begin to realize that his relationship to the patrons of the Empire Grill had changed profoundly. Before, he'd been the smart kid, Grace Roby's boy, who was going off to college to make something of himself, and thus had been the object of much gentle, good-natured ridicule. The men at the lunch counter were forever quizzing him about things. The operation of backhoes, say, or the best spot to sink a septic tank. They imagined he must be learning about at college. His complete lack of wisdom on these subjects led them to wonder out loud just what the hell they were teaching down there in Portland. Often they didn't speak to Miles directly, but through Roger Sperry, as though an interpreter already were necessary. After Roger's death, the food improved in inverse proportion to the conversation. The men at the lunch counter wouldn't have said as much to Miles, but in their opinion, he spent too much time with his back to them, attending to their sputtering hamburgers rather than their stories and grievances and jokes. While appreciative of his competence, they began to suspect that he had little interest in their conversation and, moreover, was unhappy in general. Roger Sperry had always been so glad to see them that he botched their orders. Half the fun of the Empire Grill had been razzing him for these failures. Under Miles' competent stewardship, the Empire Grill, never terribly profitable, had gone into a long, gentle decline, almost imperceptible, without the benefit of time-lapse photography, until one day it was suddenly clear that the diner was unprofitable, and so it had remained for years. Still, Miles often sensed regret in Mrs. Whiting's demeanor when she recalled her promise to bequeath him the restaurant. Sometimes she seemed to blame him for its decline and wondered out loud why she needed the aggravation of a business that produced so little revenue. But on other occasions, and there had been several of these, when Miles himself had become discouraged and offered the same argument to his employer, Mrs. Whiting quickly retreated and urged him not to give up, reminding him that the Empire Grill was a landmark, that it was the only non-fast food establishment in town, and that Empire Falls, if its residents were to remain at all hopeful about the future, needed the grill to survive, even if it didn't thrive. Even more mysterious was the feeling Miles had that Mrs. Whiting wasn't altogether pleased by recent signs that business was picking up. During the past 9 months, thanks to a bold initiative by David, the restaurant was actually beginning to turn around. And for several months that spring had actually turned a small profit. When he expressed this optimistic view to Mrs. Whiting, expecting her to be pleased by the modest reversal of fortune, she regarded both the news and its bearer suspiciously, as if she either didn't believe the numbers with which she was being presented, or feared that the Roby boys might be trying to put something over on her. Miles knew Mrs. Whiting had put the bequest in her will, because she showed him the pertinent section of the document all those years ago. What he didn't know, of course, was whether, as David cautioned, she had ever amended it. That was possible, of course, but he continued to maintain, at least to his brother, that if Mrs. Whiting said she was going to leave him the restaurant, she'd do so. However,
he had to admit it would be entirely in character for the old woman to ensure that the restaurant at the time of the transfer would be worth as little as possible. And in the meantime, it was his own responsibility to keep the Hobart running, with rubber bands if necessary. Tick was seated on the opposite drain board, listlessly munching a granola bar, waiting for the machine to complete its cycle. "I had an empire moment on the way here," she said, without much enthusiasm. "Not a great one, though. The flower shop. Mixed B-O-K-A-Y. This was a game they'd been playing for nearly a year, finding unintentional humor in the form of gaffes in the Empire Gazette, misspellings in advertisements for local stores, lapses in logic on printed signs, like the one on the brick wall that surrounded the old empty shirt factory. No trespassing without permission. They referred to the pleasure of these discoveries as empire moments, and Tick was becoming disconcertingly adept at identifying them. Last month, down in Fairhaven, she'd noticed the sign outside the town's one shabby little rumored-to-be-gay bar whose entrance was being renovated. Enter in rear. Miles was startled that his 16-year-old daughter had seen the humor in this, but he was proud, too. Still, he wondered if Janine wasn't right. She disapproved of the game from the start, viewing it as yet another opportunity for the two of them to pretend superiority to everyone else, especially herself. "Good eye," Miles nodded. "I'll look for it." By rule, they always confirmed each other's sightings. "I can do that," Tick said, when she saw her father start scraping dishes into the garbage and stacking them in the plastic rack for the next load. "Never doubted it," her father assured her. "How was school?" She shrugged. "Okay." There was precious little Miles would have changed about his daughter, but to his way of thinking, far too many things in Tick's life were okay. She was a smart kid, one who knew the difference between first-rate, mediocre, and piss-poor, but like most kids her age, she seemed bored by such distinctions. "How was the movie?" "Okay." "How were the French fries?" "Okay." "How's your sprained ankle feeling?" "Okay." Everything was pretty much okay, even when it wasn't. Even when, in fact, it was piss poor. When the entire emotional spectrum from despair to ecstasy could be summed up by a single four-letter word, what was a parent to do? Even more troubling was his suspicion that okay was designed specifically as a conversation stopper, employed in hopes that the person who'd asked the question would simply go away. The trick, Miles had learned, was not to go away. You didn't ask more probing questions because they, too, would be met with this monosyllabic evasion. The trick was silence, if there was a trick. "I made a new friend," Tick finally elaborated, once the Hobart had shuddered to a halt and she'd raised the door to extract the tray of clean dishes. Miles rinsed his hands and went over to where Tick was stacking the warm plates. He took one down from the shelf and checked it, relieved to find it squeaky clean. The Hobart would live. "Candace Burke. She's in my art class. She stole an X-Acto knife today." "What for?" Tick shrugged. "I guess she didn't have one. She starts all her sentences with, 'Oh my God, oh my God,' like, 'Oh my God, oh my God, my mascara's running,' or 'Oh my God, oh my God, you're even skinnier than last year.'" This last, Miles suspected, was not a theoretical example. Tick, always stick thin, was often accused of being anorexic. Last year, she'd even been called into the nurse's office and questioned about her eating habits. In fact, Miles and Janine had been called in as well. This was before Janine herself lost so much weight, so she and Miles, sitting there in the school counselor's tiny office, did seem to suggest that Tick couldn't possibly have come by her reed-like body honestly. Miles tried to think if he knew this Candace Burke. There were several Burke families in town. "What'd she look like?"
"Fat."
"A lot or a little?"
"She's fat like I'm skinny."
"In other words, not very," Miles ventured.
In mid-adolescence, his daughter was hard to compliment. The truth was that he thought her a heartbreakingly beautiful girl, and often tried to explain that it was her intelligence, her wit, that was keeping her from being more popular with boys. "Which Burke is she, I wonder?" Tick shrugged. "She lives with her mother, and her mother's new boyfriend down on Water Street. She says we've got a lot in common. I think she's in love with Zach. She keeps saying, 'Oh my God, he's so good looking. How can you stand it? I mean, like he was yours and now he's not.'" "Did you tell her she's not missing much?" Even now, months after their breakup, the mere mention of Zach Minty, Tick's former boyfriend, was enough to make Miles grind his teeth. His fondest hope was that Donnie, the boy Tick had met at the Vineyard, would free his daughter from any lingering attraction she might feel for a boy who, like his father and grandfather before him, bore more or less constant watching. His daughter's pause did little to reassure him. "Here's the thing," she finally said. "Now that I'm not with Zach anymore, I don't have a single friend." Tick's two best friends had moved away in the last 6 months. "Except Candace," Miles pointed out. "Oh my God, oh my God," she squealed in mock horror. "I forgot Candace." "And you forgot me," Miles pointed out. Tick shrugged, serious now. "I know. And your Uncle David?" A frown, a shrug, an apologetic, "I know. And your mother?" Just a hint of a frown. When he didn't press further, she let him take her in his arms and surrendered limply to his awkward, overlarge embrace. Usually, when Tick felt a bear hug coming, she'd position her body sideways so one of her shoulders would dig under his breastbone. It was Janine who had explained what was going on, that their daughter's late-developing breasts were probably sore. Her explanation made it clear that Janine herself hadn't cared all that much for his embraces. "I know we're not the kind of friends you had in mind," Miles told his daughter, "but we're not nobody." A sniffle now, her nose buried deep in his chest. "I know." "You gonna write to Donnie?" "What for? I'll never see him again." Miles shrugged. "Who knows?" "Me," she said, pulling away from him now. "And you?" He let her go back to unloading the Hobart. "You got homework?" She shook her head. "You want me to come back in an hour and run you home?" "Mom said she'd come by," she said. "If she forgets, the idiot can do it." "Hey," Miles said, and waited until she turned around and looked at him. "Go easy. He's trying. He just doesn't know how to be around you." "He could try being dead." "Tick. Why can't you just go ahead and admit how much you hate him?" Because he might not be able to stop there was why. Because when David had suggested murder as a solution to the Silver Fox's daily visits, Miles had almost been able to imagine it. "Big boy," Walt Como bellowed when Miles emerged from the kitchen. "Come over here a minute." Walt had taken his outer shirt off now, Miles noticed. He always wore white T-shirts with the logo of his fitness club over the left pectoral, and he always wore them a size too small so everyone could admire his still rippling at 50 torso and biceps. David had been right, of course. The Silver Fox was about to plant an elbow on the formica counter and challenge Miles to arm wrestle. "Be right there," he called, then turned to David, who was handing napkins to Horace to stuff in the dispensers. "You got help tonight?" "Charlene," David said. "I think she just pulled in." "You want me to stop by later?" "Nope." Miles shrugged. David grinned at him. "You're out the back, aren't you?" "You bet." Behind the restaurant, the first slot, beside the dumpster, was occupied by Miles' 10-year-old Jetta, the next one by Charlene's even more dilapidated Hyundai Excel. He tried to make enough noise in his approach so as not to startle her, but Charlene's radio was on loud enough that she jumped anyway when he appeared at her door. "Jesus, Miles!"
she croaked in the clenched-tooth manner of pot smokers once she rolled down the window. Sweet smoke escaped along with an old Rolling Stones song. "Give me a coronary, why don't you? I thought you were that asshole cop," meaning Jimmy Minty. "Sorry," Miles said, though in fact he wasn't entirely displeased. Most women saw Miles coming and said so. Janine clearly had. "Don't imagine you snuck up on me, Miles, because you didn't," she told him after accepting his proposal of marriage. That proposal had certainly taken him by surprise, and he'd taken this as an indication that Janine might be surprised too. But she wasn't. "The world's most transparent man," she called him. "Don't ever consider a life of crime," she advised. "You decide to rob a bank, the cops will know which one before you do." "How did things go last week?" he asked Charlene. "Slow," she said. "Dinner's picked up, though." "They've been picking up. Some of the college kids are filtering back in. Classes start next week." Dinners were a relatively new thing. Until a year ago, the restaurant was open only for breakfast and lunch, but David had suggested opening for dinner on weekends and trying to attract a different clientele, an idea opposed by Mrs. Whiting, who feared that they'd lose their old, tried-and-true customers. Miles had managed to convince her that, for the most part, tried-and-true was done and gone. In the end, she'd grudgingly consented, but only after being reassured that they wouldn't ask for an advertising budget or make any changes in the breakfast and lunch menus or pester her for expensive redecoration to accommodate the newer, more sophisticated dinner service. At David's suggestion, they began by inviting students who wrote restaurant reviews for the college paper to a free meal. The college was 7 miles away in Fairhaven, and even Miles hadn't believed that many students would make the trek. Not when their parents were already shelling out more than $25,000 a year for tuition, room, and board. But apparently there was money left over. When students started frequenting the Empire Grill, the cars parked out front, some of them anyway, were BMWs and Audis. Summer had slowed some after this luxury fleet returned to Massachusetts and Connecticut, but Friday and Saturday night still did well enough to justify staying open. David's other brainstorm was also working out. During the week, the restaurant now catered private parties. "You and David think you can handle tonight okay?" "In our sleep. Rehearsal dinner for 20 people." "Okay," Miles said, not able to conceal his disappointment at not being needed. Charlene seemed to understand all this, changed the subject. "You and Tick have a good vacation?" "Great," he said. "I wish I hadn't been so enthusiastic, actually. Now Walt's thinking about opening a fitness club on the island." "I saw his van out front," she said. "You want me to go in there and wither his dick?" "Feel free," Miles said, knowing that it was well within her power. Charlene, at 45, was still more than enough woman to produce the same effect among the smug jocks from the college. "I'm out of here anyway." "You shouldn't let him run you off, Miles." "I'm grateful he shows up. Wasn't for him, I'd probably never leave the premises." Since he and Janine separated, Miles had been living in the apartment above the restaurant. The plan had been to fix it up, make it livable, but after 6 months he still hadn't done much. Half the available living space was still occupied by cardboard boxes from the storage room in the basement, supplies that had been moved upstairs years before when the river flooded. Miles also suspected something was wrong with the apartment's heating system, since in cold weather he often woke up with headaches, feeling groggy, and half asphyxiated. Last April, he'd even considered asking Janine if he could sack out in the back bedroom for a while, until the headaches went away. But when he went over to ask her, he discovered the Silver Fox had all but moved in. Better to asphyxiate above the Empire Grill, he'd decided. "Well, if you're going somewhere, I wish you'd leave and let me finish this joint," Charlene told him. "Go ahead and finish. Who's stopping you?" "You. You know I don't feel comfortable smoking dope around you." Since this was a vaguely insulting thing to say, Miles felt compelled to ask why. "Because you're the kind of man who can never quite manage to conceal his disapproval." Miles sighed. Supposing this must be true. Janine had always said the same thing. Odd, though, the way other people saw you. Miles had always thought of himself as a model of tolerance. Chapter 2. Father Mark, returning late in the afternoon from visiting his parish shut-ins, found Miles around back of St. Catherine's, staring up at the steeple. As a boy, Miles had been a climber, so fearless that he'd driven his mother into paroxysms of terror. When it was time for dinner, she'd come looking for him, always searching at ground level, which delighted him. He loved to call down to her from the air, forcing her to look up and locate him among the blue sky's tangled branches, her slender hand rushing to cover her mouth. At the time, he'd concluded she lacked the gift of memory, always expecting him on the ground when time after time he was in the air. Now, a father himself, he knew how frightened she must have been. She hadn't looked up because there were too many trees, too many branches, too many dangers. Only when Miles swung safely down and landed at her feet was she able to smile, even as she scolded him into a promise she knew he would never keep. "You're a born climber," she'd admit on their way home. "What heights you'll scale when you're a man, I don't dare even think." Now it was Miles who didn't dare even think, of climbing anyway. Somewhere along the line he'd become terrified of heights, and the idea of painting the steeple made him weak in the knees.
"When I was a little boy," Father Mark said, "I used to think God actually lived up there."
"In the steeple?" Miles said. Father Mark nodded.
"I thought when we sang hymns we were all calling to him to come down and be among us, which of course we were, but the literal proximity was reassuring."
The two men shook hands. Miles had changed into his paint-spattered clothes but hadn't started in yet, so he was still dry. The sky in the time since Miles left the grill had grown ominous.
"God himself, a couple stories up. So close."
"I was just thinking how far away it is," Miles admitted. "But then I was contemplating painting it."
"That does make a difference," Father Mark said.
"Actually, I wasn't contemplating painting so much as falling." Interesting, Miles thought. Like himself, Father Mark as a child had been reassured by the imagined proximity of God, whereas adults, perhaps because they so often were up to no good, took more comfort from his remoteness. Though Miles didn't think of himself as a man up to no good, he did prefer the notion of an all-loving God to that of an all-knowing one. It pleased him to imagine God as someone like his mother, someone beleaguered by too many responsibilities, too dog-tired to monitor an energetic boy every minute of the day, but who, out of love and fear for his safety, checked in on him whenever she could. Was this so crazy? Surely God must have other projects besides man, just as parents had responsibilities other than raising their children. Miles liked the idea of a God who, when he at last had the opportunity to return his attention to his children, might shake his head with wonder and mutter, "Jesus, look what they're up to now." A distractible God, perhaps, one who'd be startled to discover so many of his children way up in trees since the last time he looked. A God whose hand would go rushing to his mouth in fear in that instant of recognition that, "Good God, that kid's gonna hurt himself." A God who could be surprised by unanticipated pride. Glory be, that boy is a climber. An idle daydream deity, this, Miles had to admit. In truth, when God looked down upon his mischievous children, they were usually up to far worse than climbing trees. If there were such a deity, though, and if he'd ever feared that Miles would hurt himself, he could quit worrying any time now. For all his early promise, Miles had scaled no heights, and now at 42, he was so afraid of them that he cowered near the steel doors of glass elevators, reluctant to move back away from them and let others step on.
"I thought we agreed you weren't going to attempt the steeple," Father Mark said.
"We did, I guess." Originally, Miles had imagined that by painting the church himself, he could save the parish a lot of money. But both contractors he'd spoken to about painting just the steeple wanted to charge nearly as much for that as they would have for the entire building. Annoyed that he proposed to do the safe, easy part himself, they let him know that the part he didn't want was the part nobody wanted, and that was the part that cost you. The truth of this stung. "The trouble is," Miles told his friend, "every time I look up there, it's an accusation."
"So don't look up."
"Fine advice for a man of the spirit to give," said Miles, looking up and feeling at that moment a drop of rain. Father Mark had also looked up and also felt a drop.
"Let's go over to the rectum and have a cup of coffee," he suggested. "You can tell me about your vacation."
Ever since Miles had confessed his boyhood confusion about the words rectory and rectum, Father Mark, as delighted by the mistake as Grace Roby had been, had preferred this nomenclature, even though it sometimes slipped out when it shouldn't. Such as earlier that summer when, at the end of Mass, he invited the parishioners to join him and Father Tom for lemonade on the lawn behind the rectum. St. Cat's Rectory was one of Miles' favorite places. It was bright and sunny in all seasons, warm in the winter, breezy in the summer, but probably it had more to do with the fact that Father Tom, now retired but still living in the rectory, had never allowed children there. Nor had Miles' mother ever been invited in, for that matter, so perhaps it was the exclusion that added to the attraction. All of the rooms on the bottom floor were large and high-ceilinged, with tall, uncurtained windows that allowed passers-by a glimpse of the privileged life inside. The rectum's dining room, which fronted the street, had an oak dining table long enough to seat 20 guests, though when Miles and his mother walked by late on Saturday afternoons, after having had their confessions heard, the room was occupied only by Father Tom, seated regally at one end, and his housekeeper, Mrs. Dombrowski, hovering in attendance. Back then, there had been two, sometimes three, priests in residence, but on Saturdays, Father Tom liked to take his evening meal early and would not wait for the younger priest, who always drew the late confessions. Miles' mother always remarked when they passed on how sad this seemed, but Miles didn't see anything so very odd in the practice and couldn't help wondering why it so upset his mother. By the time they'd returned home, his father would already have finished eating his sandwich and departed on foot for the neighborhood tavern. To young Miles, the forbidden rectory, so full of warmth and light and wood and books, seemed otherworldly, and he imagined that a man would have to be very rich to be a priest. The romance of the profession had stayed with him for a long time. He'd seriously considered holy orders well into high school, and there were still times when he wondered if he'd missed his calling. Janine had wondered, too. To her way of thinking, any man with no more sex drive than Miles Roby possessed might better have just gone ahead and embraced celibacy and been done with it, instead of disappointing poor girls like herself. Father Mark and Miles never had their coffee in the dining room he'd admired as a boy, preferring instead the kitchen with its cozy breakfast nook, a booth not unlike those along the front windows of the Empire Grill. Father Mark put a plate of cookies on the formica table, then poured each of them a cup of coffee. Though it was only the first week in September, already autumn was in the air, rustling the lace curtains of the open window. The drizzle had stopped as soon as they entered the rectum, but the sky remained dark. The daylight was dwindling early, giving Miles less time to work on the church. Most afternoons he managed to leave the grill by 3, but by the time he changed clothes and set up the ladder, it was at least 3:30. By 6, on cloudy days, the light was failing and it was time to quit. Of course, the real culprit wasn't the abbreviated day so much as the lengthening coffee conversations with Father Mark, who now slid into the booth opposite Miles.
"You look like your vacation did you some good," he observed.
"It did. And there's a nice chapel in Vineyard Haven. I drove into Mass most mornings. Tick came with me, and that was even better." The one good thing about her parents' breakup, Tick was on record as observing, was that at least she didn't have to go to church anymore now that her mother had replaced Catholicism with aerobics. In fact, Tick now considered herself an agnostic, a philosophical position that allowed her to sleep in on Sunday mornings. Miles knew better than to force her to go, and had not done so on the vineyard, which made him even more pleased when she dragged herself out of bed still half asleep in the mornings to accompany him. By the time Mass was over, she was fully awake, and they would enjoy a muffin together at an outdoor cafe before heading out island to Peter and Dawn's house and the rest of their lazy day at the beach. Back in Maine, he'd asked whether she thought she'd start going to church again, now that she was back in the habit, but she didn't think so. It was easier to believe in God, she said, or at least the possibility of God, on Martha's Vineyard than it was in Empire Falls. Miles knew what she meant, understood the bitter irony. Half the cars in the Vineyard Chapel's lot were Mercedes-Benzes or Lexuses. No surprise that their owners believed that God was in his heaven. And of course, Miles added, Peter and Dawn spoiled her the whole time. Worse than you do? By a mile, Miles said, chewing a cookie. Oddly, his appetite was never better than in the late afternoon here at St. Cat's. Surrounded by food all day at the restaurant, he often forgot to eat. Whereas here, if he didn't pay attention, he'd finish the entire plate of cookies. Or about as badly as I'd spoil her if I had the means. They spoiled us both, actually. Good food, a $20 bottle of wine with dinner every night. Must have been strange not having Janine there. She was invited, Miles said, surprised at the note of defensiveness in his voice. Never said she wasn't, Miles. There was plenty to occupy my thoughts without her. There are places on a stretch of private beach, and every other woman was sunbathing in the nude. When we're not there, I suspect Peter and Dawn do, too. If she had a tan line, I sure couldn't see it. How about Peter? Father Mark asked. Did he have a tan line? Didn't occur to me to look, Miles said, smiling. Father Mark smiled back. Miles, you're a true Manichaean. You seek out Mass in the morning and your friend's wife's tan line in the afternoon. Anyway, what is it they do again? Write television sitcoms. By next week, they'll have shut everything up and flown back to L.A. You should see the house that just sits there vacant 10 months out of the year. Father Mark nodded but didn't say anything. Given the priest's political leanings, Miles knew that he didn't approve of personal wealth, much less conspicuous consumption. Peter said an odd thing, actually, Miles continued, even though he made up his mind not to tell anyone about this. He said he and Dawn were astonished Janine and I stuck it out as long as we did, considering how miserable we were together. They'd been admiring for years the way we kept trying to work through our problems. Father Mark smiled. Remember, though, people from L.A. have pretty minimal expectations when it comes to coping with marital difficulties. Miles shrugged, conceding this. I guess I was just surprised that people saw us that way. Mismatched, you mean? Miles considered. Not really that so much. More that people saw us as unhappy. I wasn't all that unhappy. Or I didn't know I was, so it's strange to have friends conclude something like that. I mean, if I was so unhappy, wouldn't I know it? Possibly, Father Mark replied, but not necessarily. Miles sighed. Janine knew, I have to give her that. At least she knew how she felt. At this point, both men heard the shuffling of slippered feet in the hall. Father Mark closed his eyes, as if at the advance of a migraine. A moment later, Father Tom, his gray hair wild, his collar askew, entered and fixed Miles with a particularly menacing glare. "You want to join us, Tom?" Father Mark suggested, no doubt hoping to head off trouble. "I'll make you a cup of hot cocoa if you promise to behave." Father Tom usually loved hot chocolate, especially when he didn't have to make it himself, but it appeared he was thirstier for a good confrontation.
"Where did that evil bastard come from?" he growled.
Miles, also eager to placate the old priest, had been trying to get to his feet so he could offer to shake hands, but standing up proved no easy maneuver, since both the booth and the table were stationary.
"This is no evil bastard, Tom," Father Mark said calmly. "This is Miles, our most faithful parishioner. You baptized him and you married his parents."
"I know who he is," Father Tom said. "He's a peckerhead, and his mother was a whore. I told her so, too."
Miles sat back down. This wasn't the first time the old man, inspired by only God knew what, had taken one look at Miles and offered a poor opinion of his moral character, though he'd never before insulted the memory of Miles' mother. This was clearly an old man's dementia talking, but for the second time that afternoon, Miles fleetingly considered how satisfying it would be to send another human being into the next world, this time a priest.
"Look at him. Look at that face. He knows it's true," the old man said, taking in Miles' paint-spattered overalls. "He's a filthy degenerate is what he is. He's tracking his filth into my house."
Father Mark sighed.
"You're wrong all around, Tom. First, it's not your house."
"It's true,"
he said. "No, the house belongs to the parish, as you're well aware." Father Tom seemed to consider the unfairness of this arrangement, then finally shrugged.
"And Miles isn't a degenerate," the younger priest said. "He's covered with paint because he's painting the church for us, remember? For free."
The old man squinted first at his colleague, then at Miles. Always a frugal man in the extreme, Father Tom might have been expected to be mollified by this news, but instead he continued to glare fiercely, as if to suggest that no good deed could disguise the fundamental evil of Miles' heart.
"I may be old," he conceded, "but I still know a peckerhead when I see one."
Father Mark, his patience exhausted, slid out of the booth and took him by the shoulders, rotating him gently but firmly.
"Tom," he said, "look at me."
When he continued to glare at Miles, Father Mark placed the tip of his fingers on the old man's stubbled chin, turning his head.
"Look at me, Tom."
Finally he did, and his expression instantly morphed from disgust to shame.
"Tom," Father Mark said, "remember what we talked about before?"
If so, he showed no sign, as he studied Father Mark through red, rheumy eyes.
"I'm sorry you're not feeling well today, but this sort of behavior is intolerable. You owe our friend an apology."
To Miles, Father Tom resembled nothing more than a scolded child, convinced against his better instincts by a loving parent that he'd been a bad boy. He glanced back at Miles to see if it was possible to owe such a man an apology, then returned to Father Mark's stern gaze. The two men stared at each other long enough to make Miles squirm. But finally, Father Tom turned to Miles and said,
"Forgive me."
Miles didn't hesitate.
"Of course, Father Tom, I'm sorry too."
And he was sorry. Satisfying or not, it wouldn't have been a good thing to kill an elderly priest, which also suggested it was not a good thing to wish for.
"There," Father Mark said, "that's better. Isn't it nicer for all of us when we're friends?"
Father Tom appeared to consider this extremely dubious, again studying Miles for several long beats before shaking his head and shuffling out of the room. Miles couldn't be sure, but he thought he heard one more peckerhead escape the old man's lips out in the hallway. Father Mark continued to stare at the doorway as the sound of shuffling slippered feet receded. The expression on the younger priest's face wasn't quite as tolerant as one might have expected of a clergyman.
"It's okay," Miles assured him. "Father Tom and I go way back, you know. He's not himself."
"You think not?" Father Mark asked.
"It's not his fault that stuff comes out."
"True," Father Mark said. "Interesting that it's there to begin with, though. I understand why it's coming out, but how do you suppose it got in there?"
"Well,
I know," Father Mark grinned.
"An eternal question answered in Genesis. Still, I'm sorry he said what he did.
I have no idea where he comes up with such things. He probably doesn't even remember your mother. Miles forced himself to consider this possibility. True, the old man's mind was gone. The problem was, it wasn't completely gone. And Father Tom's eyes, especially when he was angry, often appeared to be ablaze with both intelligence and memory. Actually, she's been on my mind lately, Miles said, adding, I have no idea why. Though he did know. It was the vineyard that had done it, just as it did every summer. Outside, the rain had begun again, steadier now beneath the low sky. Miles pushed his empty coffee cup toward the center of the table. Well, it doesn't look like I'm painting anything today, he said, sliding out of the booth. Somehow the plate of cookies was empty, and Miles could feel the last of them lodged uncomfortably in his gullet. Together, the two men went out onto the porch, where they stood listening to the rain. How many more days do you have on the north face? Father Mark asked, contemplating the church. A couple, Miles said. Maybe tomorrow and the next day, if the weather clears. You really should stop right there, Father Mark advised. I've been hearing more rumblings from the diocese. We may be out of business before long. I suspect poor Tom's the only thing that saved us until now. For more than a year now, rumors had persisted that St. Catherine's Parish would be combined with Sacred Heart on the other side of town. Empire Falls, once sufficiently endowed with Catholics to support both, had been losing religious enthusiasm along with its population. Now the only reason for two parishes was simply that Sacré Cœur, as Sacred Heart was still known to most of its French-Canadian parishioners, required a French-speaking pastor. Otherwise, the parishes could have been combined years ago. Father Mark suspected that Sacré Cœur would be the survivor, and that he would be shipped elsewhere. He didn't speak French, whereas Father Thibodeau was bilingual. What hadn't been resolved was what to do with Father Tom. While there were homes for elderly retired priests, especially for those in ill health, his dementia, which vacillated between the obscene and the downright blasphemous, made the diocese cautious about placing him among elderly but otherwise normal clergymen, most of whom had served too long and too well to have their faith tested further in their final years by a senile old man whose favorite word was peckerhead. Besides, Father Mark was able to handle the old priest, who had lived in St. Cat's Rectory for 40 years and was comfortable there. In a sense, it was his house, just as he maintained. Also, there were words worse than peckerhead, and if the diocese tried moving Father Tom, he might start using them. Hearing him carry on had already converted several of St. Catherine's Catholics, some to Episcopalianism, a few others to fearful agnosticism, and the bishop didn't want to risk his contaminating other priests. No, the diocese seemed to believe that they had the Father Tom situation under control, and until now they'd shown no desire to break containment. "Have you gotten any sense of where you might be assigned?" Miles asked. "Not really," Father Mark said. "I suspect they're not through punishing me, though." He had a doctorate in Judaism, and the perfect position for him would be at the Newman Center of a college or university. That was the sort of post he held in Massachusetts before he made the mistake of joining a group of protesters who climbed the fence of a New Hampshire military installation and got arrested for whacking away at the impervious shell of a nuclear sub with ball-peen hammers, an act that Father Mark had considered symbolic, but that the base commander, a literalist, had interpreted as an act of sabotage and treason. Not that this protest had been Father Mark's only offense. In addition to teaching and pastoring at the university's Newman Center, Father Mark had also hosted his Sunday evening radio show, during which he had drawn his bishop's ire by counseling loving monogamy for a young male caller, regardless of the boy's sexual orientation, and further advising him to trust God's infinite understanding and mercy. Apparently, what happened to young, overeducated, rumored-to-be-gay priests who'd landed cushy campus gigs and doled out liberal advice was that they got packed off to Empire Falls, Maine, probably in hopes that God would freeze their errant peckers off. I hope they don't have any worse duty in mind for you, Miles said, trying to imagine what such a thing might be. Father Mark shrugged, studying the half-painted church. They can't really hurt you unless you let them. I certainly don't regret coming to St. Cat's. She's been a good old gal, and I wouldn't have missed out on our friendship.
I know, Miles said. Me neither. Then after a moment, I wonder what will become of her.
Hard to say. Some of these beautiful old churches are being bought up and renovated into community theaters, art centers, things like that.
I don't think that would work here, Miles said. Empire Falls has even less interest in art than religion.
Still, you'd better quit when you finish the North Phase. You could be painting Empire Falls' next Baptist church.
The house he grew up in, on Long Street, had been on the market for more than a year, and Miles was parked across the street, trying to imagine what sort of person would purchase it in its present condition. The side porch, dangerous with rot even when he was a boy, had been removed but not replaced. Visible evidence of where it had been wrenched away remained in four ugly, unpainted scars. Anybody who left the house by the back door, the only one Miles had ever used, would now be greeted by a 6-foot drop into a patch of poisonous-looking weeds and rusted hubcaps. The rest of the structure was gray with age and neglect, its front porch sloping crazily in several different directions, as if the house had been built on a fissure. Even the for sale sign on the terrace tilted. Several different families had rented the house since his mother's death, none of them, apparently, interested in preventing or even forestalling its decline. Of course, to be fair, Miles had to admit that the decline had begun under the Robys' own stewardship. On what had once been a tidy, middle-class street, theirs and the minty place next door were the first houses to prefigure the deterioration of the whole neighborhood. Miles's father, though a sometime house painter, had been disinclined to paint any house he himself happened to be living in. Summers he was busy working on the coast, and by October he would pronounce himself all painted out, though he sometimes could be induced to work for a week or so if the landlord, with whom they had a reduced rent arrangement contingent upon Max's keeping the house painted and in good repair, complained or threatened eviction. Resentful of such a strict, literal interpretation of their agreement, Max retaliated by painting the house half a dozen different, largely incompatible colors from the numerous leftover, half-empty cans he'd appropriated from his various summer jobs. The Roby cellar was always full of stacked gallon cans, their lids slightly askew, the damp, rotting shelves full of open mason jars of turpentine, the fumes from which permeated the upstairs throughout the winter. Miles was in fourth grade when one of his friends asked what it was like to live in the joke house, a remark he passed along not